Jobs, The Fed, MC Hammer, and Three Pointers. Happy Friday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, California, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, April 5th. Good to have you with us. Plenty of economic news to kick around, from big-time jobs numbers today to the president's ongoing criticism of the Fed and his, shall we say, idiosyncratic nominations to that body. Let's chew it over with Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Dion Raboan, markets editor at Axios. Hi there.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Let's start, I think, before we dive into this Fed situation, let's start with the jobs numbers. Broadly, I guess more of the same, especially in terms of wages. Dion, I'm going to start with you. Food and housing still cost a lot. So at what point do these stuck wages really start to hurt the economy?
Ooh, that's a really good question, because they have actually been moving in the right direction, but now they're kind of stuck and might be moving back down. The thing about this jobs report today was it didn't really tell us anything new about the economy. Everything was kind of on trend, along the same trend that we've been going on really since the end of the recession and the beginning of the recovery in 2009. So you got back to 196,000 jobs added. That's about a long trend that we've seen really for the past 9-10 years. Wage growth kind of moving back towards its trend. And we're really, this is just kind of a return to the normal that we've seen over the past 10 years. So didn't really tell us anything new about the economy except, you know, the new boss, same as the old boss.
Right. And Lynette, our reporters say, you know, 3.2% is okay as far as wage growth goes, but we'd need 3.5% to 4% for a sustained period for workers to gain back this ground. And getting to the Fed, it seems like that wouldn't be that likely if inflation hawks start saying it's time to raise interest rates. Is that fair?
That's fair. But here's the thing. I'm one of those people who believes that the American worker hasn't really gotten a sufficient raise since the 1960s. So when I look at these 3.2 numbers, these 4% numbers, it compares to, you know, it does not compare to, you know, the lack of ground that the American worker has not made. I mean, the American workers' purchasing power has basically stayed steady for the last 40 years. And this is why we've seen such massive inequality. So when I see a report like this and we start quibbling over 3.2%, 4%, I'm like, okay. I mean, fine.
Right.
But we can quibble over it. But it's not going to change what is, you know, an inherent structural problem with our economy right now.
Well, then let's move on to the structure
of
the economy writ large. That's what Lynette does. You know, she comes and drops
the bomb. I was like, wah, wah. Sorry.
I mean, we keep calling you, so it's on us. Dion, broadly, let's talk about the Fed. You have these proposed nominations in Stephen Moore and now Herman Cain. And I think what we should ask with all of this pressure and these kind of weird nominations is, yeah, can the Fed do its job?
Yeah, no, of course the Fed can do its job. And it is important to point out that these are just two nominations of, I think it's 12 board seats. You've also got the chair, the vice chair. You've got a number of Fed regional presidents, all of whom, everyone on the Fed currently, very qualified, including the previous people that President Trump has nominated. I really think, though, it's important that we reframe this debate or the conversation that's going on about these nominations. Everyone keeps saying Trump is nominating these people because he wants the Fed to roll back interest rates. He wants them to cut rates, not hike rates. The president's even said that. Trump doesn't understand how the Fed works. He doesn't understand what the Fed does. He doesn't understand monetary policy. He doesn't understand economics. He's nominating these people because he wants more people like him on the board. It's not about
loosening policy. Not necessarily like him, but people who will do what he says. In every instance, the president replaces the rule of law and, you know, nonpartisanship with the rule of himself. And he believes that Stephen Moore and Herman Cain will perpetuate this rule of himself on the Fed board. Now, is that true? Unclear. We're going to have to look at the minutes once they join, and we'll have to see if Republicans in the Senate are actually, you know, craven and, you know, foolish enough to vote these people in. I mean, Stephen Moore himself has admitted that it's going to be a learning curve. The man's not an economist. Mm-hmm. He's more of a talking head.
To Dion's point, though, it's a big deliberative body with some independent minds, right? Dion, like you sound like you're saying the board could withstand the pressure. We got about 30 seconds for this one.
The board could withstand the pressure. And again, these guys aren't going to put much pressure on because they don't know what they're doing.
No
Stephen
clue.
Moore, right. Stephen Moore has no clue. Herman Fed at least was on the Fed before. I think he understands the processes of the Fed, is not really eminently qualified. And I think Raphael Bostic must be just with his head in his hands, like it took 50 years to get a brother on the Fed and now they're going to put him on. But, you know, again, these people aren't – Trump's not nominating these people because he wants interest rates lower. He's nominating these people because he wants more people like him who he feels excited about nominating. He doesn't understand what the Fed does, and he's made that clear with his comments today.
Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Dion Rabowan, markets editor at Axios. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
Now to prepaid debit cards, the increasingly popular plastic cards with MasterCard or Visa logos that let you shop anywhere with preloaded money. They're a growing part of this economy and the financial services industry, but they can be risky. There aren't any protections against theft or purchases that are defective or unauthorized charges. But this week, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau started requiring safeguards on prepaid cards that are the same as debit cards that are tied to bank accounts. Marketplace's Erica Barris has more on that.
Employers use prepaid cards to pay their workers, governments to disperse benefits like unemployment. People who use debit cards from banks have had protection against fraud and loss for 40 years. Now says Nick Burke with the Consumer Finance Project.
People have pretty much the same rights to be protected and get their money back if somebody steals their prepaid card as they do when they use a credit card or a debit card.
Consumers who report a lost or stolen prepaid card within 2 days are only responsible for $50 in losses. If they wait 60 days, it could cost them $500. These new rules come as prepaid cards have risen in popularity. Credit card industry analyst Ted Rossman says more than 8 million households don't have bank accounts.
So there are a lot of people who are using prepaid cards as an alternative to the traditional banking system.
Another reason for the uptick in prepaid cards, it's pretty cheap for employers, the government, and others to load the cards with money, says David Robertson with Nielsen Journal.
Plastic cards are, you know, it costs a quarter, you know, to give somebody a plastic card with a magnetic stripe. Just mailing a check would cost you more than that.
Card issuers, though, now have to change their packaging and the language they use when they issue new cards. Ben Jackson is with Innovative Payments Association.
The rules are very, very prescriptive. And then they had to begin printing extra disclosures.
The Mercator Advisory Group says hundreds of billions of dollars are loaded on prepaid cards each year. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Wall Street loves good job numbers, and it doesn't mind low inflation either. All the details when we do the numbers. We need one of those fun little websites here, hasbrexithappened.com, and it would still say no. Headed into the weekend, the situation is as foggy as a London day. British Prime Minister Theresa May has asked the European Union for an extension on Brexit. She's hoping for June 30th. If EU says no, April 12th would be the exit day. And all this uncertainty is taking a toll on British nerves. The government is offering counseling to civil servants who are stressed out by Brexit. Police chiefs have been warning Brexit protesters and campaigners to keep their tempers under control. But one London gym thinks it has hit on the antidote. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Stop Brexit!
For Remainers protesting here outside Parliament, Brexit makes their blood boil.
I am so angry, so angry.
Alice Colombo and fellow protester Helen Slater can't stop seething about Brexit.
When I wake up in the morning, my thoughts turn to Brexit.
And what do you feel?
Frustration, anger, and depression.
And it's the same for the Leavers protesting here. Relief is at hand, however. This gym, not far from Parliament, is offering a tailor-made outlet for all these pent-up Brexit emotions. Rory McEntee of the Gym Box chain came up with the idea of a BrexFit exercise class.
Brexit is probably number one in terms of frustration that are building, and this was a way for people to kind of come in together and the community and kind of vent their anger of the whole situation.
Come on! They know what
whipping them up with grime, grunge and Afro-bashment music, trainer Boris puts the participants through their paces.
Have you ever been angry? So now is the time to release.
In one exercise, Boris has them pummeling a couple of punch bags, one bearing the image of Prime Minister Theresa May, the other her chief European adversary, Jean-Claude Juncker.
You pick one you want to go for. All I want you to do is engage your body as much as you can and then go for a sucker punch on him.
In another routine, a weighted ball bearing an image of leading Brexiteer Nigel Farage is lifted above the head and slammed to the ground. And there's a rowing machine called the Romona. This is all a great marketing wheeze, of course, but trainer Boris insists it serves a practical purpose too.
What we're trying to do is to get that rage and frustration within our members and use it as a motivational tool in order to work harder and perform themselves better within exercises.
The Brexercises have been a terrific hit. The BrexFit classes are fully subscribed, but as Rory McEntee concedes, the gym equipment's taking a hell of a beating.
The punch bags we had to replace. We had Theresa May's face on the slam ball, which actually had to be replaced twice.
3, 2, 1, switch!
Jimbox says leavers and remainers have worked out together here harmoniously without venting their anger on each other. Remainers Emma Murley, Tanya Allen and Elle Phillips all seemed happy with the class, more or less.
So hard. I'm dying right now.
You don't feel more relaxed about Brexit?
No.
I thought the boxing bags were hilarious.
Just a really fun class and it's very amusing. Take the mick out of it all.
And let off steam.
Definitely, definitely anger management.
The class is beginning to imitate Brexit. The sessions are frequently extended. Oh, and last week's class was postponed. BrexFit seems likely to run and run. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We've got tons more coverage of Brexit on our website, marketplace.org, including a great episode of the Make Me Smart podcast, hosted by myself and Kai Rizdahl. Go check it out. Okay, we're coming from London right back here to Oakland, home of MC Hammer. He of You Can't Touch This, Too Legit to Quit, and Hammer Pants. And tomorrow night, MC Hammer begins his first major concert tour since 1991. And the tour will include some other acts you might remember from the 80s and 90s. Coolio, Sir Mix-a-Lot, and Cisco, among others. I am totally going to this. Marketplace's Mariel Segura takes a look at the business of the throwback concert.
Does anybody know what time it is?
Hammer time!
Yeah, you remember this one. Those pants. The sick dance moves. Dondrick Joseph is 34. He's from Houston, Texas. And he was a huge MC Hammer fan growing up. Even had the action figure.
You know, MC Hammer was kind of like a superhero when I was a kid.
He says he's going to this concert. He's actually been watching some of the rehearsal videos Hammer's posted on Twitter.
I mean, he's still at it, so I can only imagine that he's going to bring that same energy from, you know, the early 90s to 2019.
Throwback or nostalgia concerts where bands reunite or singers come out of semi-retirement aren't new, but we are looking at the latest iteration with acts from the 90s. Think Vanilla Ice and En Vogue. Jesse Kirschbaum at New Agency says what concert goers are buying here is a feeling.
They're paying to go back to where they once were. They're paying to feel like a kid again.
And for something to put on Instagram. You know, bragging rights. Spice Girls superfan, 29-year-old Cassandra Bell, never got those the first time around.
I remember the concert came to our hometown and some of my friends went and I was so jealous.
So this summer, she's flying from California to the UK to see Scary, Baby, Ginger, and Sporty on their reunion tour. Posh isn't coming. There is something returning performers have to remember, especially in the age of social media. Larry Miller teaches the business of music at NYU Steinhardt.
You need to bring it. You need to be in great shape. The tour needs to be well rehearsed.
Doesn't seem like that's going to be a problem for MC Hammer.
I told you, homeboy, you can't touch this.
I'm Mariel Segura for Marketplace.
Can't touch this.
Coming up.
Now, nobody tells you that, like, your business plan is just a plan.
And no plan survives contact with city permitters. But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks climbed after the better-than-expected monthly jobs report we told you about. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 40 points, about a tenth of a percent, to close at 26,424. The NASDAQ climbed 46 points, half a percent, to finish at 7,938. And the S&P 500 advanced 13 points, that's four-tenths of a percent, to end at 2,892. For the week that was, the Dow added 1.9%, the NASDAQ picked up 2.7%, and the S&P 500 rose 2%. Snap had a great week, jumped 4.9% a day after launching a new advertising network, hoping to compete with Facebook, Google, and LinkedIn. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.49%, and you're listening to Marketplace. Hey guys, Molly Wood here, and you gotta check out the latest episode of Make Me Smart. But you better hurry. April 15th is fast approaching, and that means tax day. This is the first year that your taxes are affected by the 2017 GOP tax law, the biggest change to tax law in 30 years. And even though the bottom line is pretty much the same for a lot of people, this year's taxes feel different.
2 million fewer people had filed their taxes this year compared to the same time last year. And when we talked to people and to accountants, they said, yeah, it's because we're scared.
Make Me Smart. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to podcast. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Basketball fans are basically in heaven right now between the final weekend of March Madness and the NBA playoffs right around the corner. They start April 13th. Fans of the three-point shot are especially loving life right now. There was a new three-point record in the NCAA tournament, and it broke the one that used to be held by NBA champ Steph Curry of the Golden State Warriors here in Oakland. And he is a big reason why successful three-point shots in the NBA have increased for the last 7 years straight. And a couple years ago, brag time, I actually talked to Steph Curry and I asked him whether he thinks the three-pointer just has a better economic return.
I don't want to try to think about it too much on the court. Just do what I do. But having done the advanced analytics on it, it does make sense.
Now, someone has done those advanced analytics. Dr. Rachel Marty Pike has used a combination of high-resolution video and artificial intelligence to determine how athletes can sink more three-pointers. Welcome to the program.
So great to be here.
How do you go about studying how to make more three-pointers?
Yeah, so we've looked at three-pointers in a new high-resolution way, where we can look at how the ball is actually going through the air so we can understand why players miss. So the group that I work, or the company I work with, is called NOAA Basketball, and they've put this sensor above the basket that's tracking who's taking the shot with facial recognition, where that shot's taken from, whether the shot makes it or misses, and then how the shot either makes or misses. And we can use that in order to train algorithms that better predict who would be a good shooter in the long run than we could simply with shooting percentage, which is a really cool advancement and gives tremendous power to general managers and coaches as they're selecting players for their roster.
Which is interesting because, you know, I'm sure that every Golden State Warriors fan would want to tell you that Steph Curry is a magical genius, right? Or Klay Thompson has a skill that can never be replicated. But what you're saying is it's like golf, right? It's something you can practice. You could really work toward this.
Oh, you can definitely practice. That doesn't mean it's easy, but there's a quantitative goal to get to, for sure.
Do you feel like managers and coaches will look at this research and say, we want to invest this time and money into getting players to be better at three-pointers because we get more points out of it?
Yeah, we've seen this tremendous shift over the last decade or two decades where players are going from shooting a lot of mid-range shots to shooting many more three-pointers and short twos, simply because we just have a higher return points per possession. And no NBA general manager or coach is going to give up those precious points. Everyone's trying to get that edge.
And then what does it mean for fans? On the one hand, people love high-scoring games, but on the other hand, you know, it's controversial that there are too many attempted and failed three-pointers and that can ruin the game. What's your view on that and whether this trend, you know, will make fans more likely to tune in and thereby make money for those teams too?
I think there's an economic benefit for it. Shooting more three-pointers speeds up the game, which, as we become more and more attention deficit culture, that is a benefit for the NBA. But also it opens up the lane. So we get more interesting one-on-one game with the open space in the middle of the key. And so I think all around for players and for fans, I think it's really a benefit to the game.
What made you want to study the three-pointer in this way? Is there like an appetite now for, you know, kids who are going into college and they're trying to become specialists?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's picking up on this trend and they want to be the best three-point shooter. As a collegiate player myself, I loved shooting the three. But I think what really brought about this research was the availability of the tech to measure shots in high resolution. And so we've seen this trend of moving to more and more three-pointers, but we've never really been able to understand what makes a good three-point shooter beyond just shooting percentage. And now we can understand why players miss, and we can predict how they will improve. And this merging of artificial intelligence and basketball is a really powerful thing and really promising for the future of the sport.
Dr. Rachel Marty Pike is a data scientist with the basketball analytics company NOAA Basketball and a former NCAA athlete. Thanks so much for coming on.
So great to be here. Thank you.
From time to time, we have a series here called My Economy, stories about people making a go of it in this economy. And for the latest installment, the story of a budding entrepreneur.
My name is Maurice Harris, and I am the owner of Bloom & Plume Coffee, located here in Echo Park in Los Angeles, California. I've lived there for 15 years. I've seen rapid change happening in the neighborhood, buildings going up left and right. And I was just like, my neighborhood is changing and I can either be a part of the solution or just complain about it. My first business, which is flowers, is an extremely luxurious business. Our opening price point for arrangements is $200 plus delivery. I mean, I can't afford that and I own the business. Then I was thinking about, okay, but like a $5 latte, that's approachable. My brother came aboard and was like, I think this is actually a good idea. And he started a whole business plan that was flawless and beautiful and amazing. I mean, I'm saying that, but like, was it? I think it was, actually. Now, nobody tells you that like your business plan is just a plan. When you get into reality and you bust open walls and the city and the health department and building and safety come through to do their inspections, you have no idea what they're going to say or what's going to happen. And so whatever your business plan is, you should probably have at least 40% more resources available to you because your project is never even kind of going to come close to what you think it's going to be. The biggest frustration of the whole project was the electricity. The city required us to upgrade the whole building, not just our space. That came with an 11-month delay, just right there. Period. No answers. Stop project. We were supposed to open up December of 2017. Then we were supposed to open up winter of 2018. Then it was supposed to be April. I was very conscientious about wanting this space to be a place where everybody can go and everybody can afford it. But with an 11-month delay, what happens to your price point of what you're selling? It immediately has to go back to the customer because now we have all these loans to pay, we have all these employees to pay, and our reserve has just like literally been deleted by that 11-month delay. We want our price point to be engaging so that everybody feels like, wow, this is of good value. It's not just like some fancy place that forgets about all the people that are here. But that has been a really, really tricky equation to figure out because of money.
How great is Maurice? And this series only works with your help. Let us know how your economy is doing at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, I am just making this a shameless Oakland show because if I've inspired you with our rap history and our basketball lore, know that Oakland is also known for Lake Merritt, a man-made lake surrounded by a park that features gondola rides with singing gondoliers. I even know one of them. Anyway, the gondola company, Gondola Servicio, also runs along the Napa River in Napa Valley and has just put itself up for sale. Pricing is unknown, but hey, make an offer. All right, they're not going to let me do this anymore. Today, the Dow gained 40 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ climbed 46 points, that's 0.5%. The S&P 500 advanced 13 points, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager, and I am Molly Wood. Have a great weekend, and don't worry, Kai's back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.